Okay, well, I spent my first 25 years in UK. I was born in Northwest London, and 5 years before World War II, and so we got evacuated during the war to Northwest Wales. My first memories were actually sitting around a kitchen table discussing why one of our Siamese cats had disappeared. Came back a few days later dragging a rabbit trap behind him. So anyhow, we went to Northwest Wales, and I was sent off to a prep school, boarding school, who had also been evacuated from near Dover to Herefordshire, not too far away from Wales. So off I went to boarding school there, and didn't enjoy it very much. And we eventually returned to London for most of the Blitz. And we used to, just as a matter of interest, we had a Morrison shelter. You know what a Morrison shelter is?
Is that the one in the backyard where you covered?
No, that's an Anderson shelter.
Okay.
Morrison shelter is a great big sheet of thick steel, about almost the size of this room, size of a double bed anyhow, and it's on four corner angle iron pillars and very heavy reinforcing wire around it. And the idea is the whole family could get underneath there, and if the house collapsed, you'd be all right. Only trouble was when the sirens went off and we got carried down there as kids, probably half asleep or went down, you'd forget where you were when you woke up. And that could explain a lot, because you used to sit up and go boing right on the forehead usually. But we used to, for young kids age about 10 or less, the war was a very exciting time for us. And we typically enjoyed rummaging through houses which had been bombed out, and collecting shrapnel and swapping that, and patrolling the sewers with air rifles and firing off officers' Webley revolvers and that sort of thing. Lots of good stuff for kids, but gosh, who knows what my parents went through.
Awful days.
Mm. So anyhow, after the war was over, when I was 12, I was sent off to another boarding school, which was one of the better public schools now in England. And I didn't enjoy my time there either.
So where was that?
Oh, that was in Northamptonshire, a place called Oundle, O-U-N-D-L-E. And the school is pretty famous now. I didn't enjoy my time there. It was very much Tom Brown's school days there, with fagging and beatings and all sorts of nasty stuff going on. So that's why I didn't bother to chase them up at all later on in life. Finally, somebody in our local computer group, Coffee and Chat, said, why don't you look them up on the website? So I looked up on the website and found they had a head girl. Could not believe it. There wasn't a girl within 25 miles of the place when we were there, and we weren't allowed bicycles or anything. Couldn't go on public transport, so we were pretty limited in where we could go. So I eventually got back to them and came in from the cold, as it were, and told them where I was and a little bit of background, and they welcomed me with open arms. I was quite surprised. And then, all those things in that school magazine, you know, it's always somebody corporate headquarters and saying how the school made a man of them, and they you know. So I wrote a thing for the school magazine and said that I didn't enjoy my time at all, which I've never seen another one like it. So, spent till I was 16 there, so I was 12 and a half, so about 4 years, 5 years. I left there in 1952. And the reason I left at 16 was that I had a choice of being a choral scholar in King's College or going to this particular school, which was very much engineering oriented, and luckily I took the latter path. So my father actually got some captains of industry to talk to me and say what they were looking for. And they all said, look, don't go to university, go and do an apprenticeship. We want to see people with practical skills. So that's what I did. I left at 16 and became an apprentice in Marconi Instruments in St. Albans. Spent five pretty happy years there, even though we had to work. We just get one day off a week for Tech College and three nights. So you were three nights and one day off during the week, and very little time for socialising or anything, and that went on for 5 years. And got my degrees and things that way, and various things like transistor theory even. Nice. And servo systems, stuff like that. Well, the first thing was, I just couldn't believe that people would call you by your first name when I left school. I mean, you know, it was always Saxon this, Saxon that, Saxon minor, Saxon major, whatever. But I couldn't believe that people would call you by your first name and look at you as a human being instead of some sort of incorrect person at that school. So anyhow, I did my 5 years, and then I became I went down and I stayed in London for about 2 or 3 years working for the head office of Marconi Instruments in London, in Marconi House, which was part of English Electric House, as it became. I don't know what it's called these days, but it's at the end of the Strand, right on the Aldwych, the end of the Strand. I worked there for 2 or 3 years. I was in the sales office there and had three secretaries working for me. I used to dictate all the time. Yeah. But eventually I got fed up with that, and by this time I had, all through my apprenticeship, I commuted on motorbikes, which is quite fun in the black ice and rutted ice season in England. Fell off a lot of times, but never did any major damage except when I cracked the back chassis of a Jaguar XKSS. Parked without any lights on the corner of a narrow road. So anyhow, by the time I there was no point in having any sort of a vehicle in London, and after I left London, I was my mother talked me into buying a Messerschmitt. Right. Have you ever seen a Messerschmitt bubble car?
Yes, I have.
I've actually got some pictures somewhere. But that was absolutely brilliant. I really enjoyed that, and I went up, and I was working for Marconi's up in Hull. I was in Hull to start with, and I used to commute on this motorcycle down to Bournemouth, which is a long way away. But you know, this thing was hotted up; it would do 70 miles an hour, and you were that far off the ground, so it was quite exciting. And I used to go around all these farmers and on the Yorkshire Dales and try to sell them moisture meters and pH meters and moisture and timber meters and things. And I don't know what they made out of me turning up in this little Messerschmitt up in the Yorkshire Dales. So yeah, I eventually became the works manager of a little small company making seismic equipment, geophones in particular, and also other seismic equipment. It was actually an American company, and they had a number of places around Europe, and we were the only ones making a profit, but they shut us down anyhow eventually. And
what company was that?
It was called Seismic Instruments, I think. It was a Houston-based company. I think they're still around probably, but they shut down all of their European operations because they were losing money quite heavily. And they wouldn't. I redesigned their seismometer for them to be a lot more efficient, using proper magnets and things, which were much better than they had on their standard line. And I got told, we don't want any ideas from you, Limeys. So that was their attitude. They didn't want to change. Anyhow, they shut us down, and I had to go off to the equivalent of the CES, or the labour exchange, or whatever they call them in those days. And I was this company was in a place called Boreham Wood, which is north of London, not far from St Albans, where I was living. We were living in Northwood at that time, but it's another story. So I went off to the labour exchange, and they said, "What do you know about inertial navigation?" I said, "I don't know anything about inertial navigation. What is it?" You know, and they said, "Oh, well, you'll be all right. You go off and see Elliott Brothers London Limited, who are looking for people to work on inertial navigation systems." So I went along, and they asked me what I knew about inertial navigation, and I said I didn't know anything. And they said, "Well, join the club. None of us do." And they were fairly well advanced on their development cycle. And they gave me various jobs to do, like improving the performance of their low noise amplifiers and various things, which I was singularly unsuccessful at. Or, well, I made some improvements, but nothing spectacular. So eventually they said, "How would you like to join the trials unit for this missile system which this inertial navigator is going to be fitted to?" I said, "Great. Where is it?" And they said, "Oh, it's up in Woodford, which is near Manchester, British Aerospace these days." And it was Avro's in those days. And so off I went in my little Messerschmitt, or I might have bought another car by then. I had a Ford Special fiberglass, looked like a DB2 stroke 4. I was in my James Bond period by then. So off I went to the north of England there, to just outside Manchester, south of Manchester, almost into Cheshire. And it was brilliant. Had a little trials team there, maybe 20 people for Elliott's, and we were preparing the inertial navigators to go into the missile, which was called Blue Steel. A big thing, about 7 tons and 30 foot long, 7 foot wingspan, that type of thing, with a rocket motor in the back, and could be a hydrogen bomb in the front. Luckily they never dropped any in anger, as far as I'm aware. But it was the middle of the Cold War. I probably wouldn't do it these days, but it seemed a reasonable thing to do in those days. And so we were doing work up there in the Woodford site, and it was fairly hush-hush. I was employed by Elliott's, and they put me in the analysis section. And me and about four other guys, were doing the analysis, comparing the actual trajectories against inertial navigation trajectories and all this type of thing. And we were solving third order differential equations using Friedan calculators, you know, the old chomp, chomp, chomp calculators. And so that we learnt our craft a little bit then, and there were some flights going on with missiles underneath, so they up at Averroes, so we could get some data to work on. Yes, so all of this work up in Averroes at Woodford was to prepare us to come out to Australia for the flight trials proper, where those missiles, over £1 million each, were dropped over Woomera. And so eventually we came down to Australia, and the first flight I made to Australia was there was a regular weekly service that the RAF used to run down to Australia in those days, particularly to support all the trials at Woomera. And the first flight I was on was actually a Comet 4. It was quite advanced. Later on we went in Britannias and things which weren't as good. But the Comet 4, yes, we left from Lynham Air Force Base on Salisbury Plain with snow on the ground, and we stayed overnight in a Nissen hut with a coal brazier, and we all froze, and 5 o'clock in the morning we piled onto this Comet 4, and the first stop was El Adam in the middle of the Sahara Desert with camels walking all around. It was just amazing. Just couldn't believe this jet travel could get you in a few hours from south of England to middle of the desert. So then we went. It was a very civilized way to fly. Used to take 7 days to get to Australia. Always had a weekend in Changi Air Force Base, which was an RAF base back then. There was no such thing as Changi Airport. And so you never got jet lagged or anything because it took 7 days to get there. And you stayed overnight in Aden was one stop. Mount Lavinia Hotel in Colombo, I remember, or on the coast of Ceylon, which was a nice spot. And then Singapore, Changi, and then down to Darwin, and then from Darwin down to Edinburgh Airfield in South Australia. So all our flights were made from Edinburgh Airfield, and I was lucky enough to get involved in the flying side as well, and I did many flights in all three V bomber classes, Valiant Victors and Vulcans, and racked up quite a few hundred hours in those. I dropped quite a number of Blue Steels at Woomera, including the most accurate one ever, which was 84 foot, 6.5 inches from the pin, 100 miles downrange, which was pretty good for those days, because you had to correct all the errors. It took about 3 or 4 hours to launch one of these things. You'd fly and you'd fix on loads of radar fixed points. I was pretty happy doing that, as well as analysing the results when we got back. And occasionally, if somebody else was flying, we had another guy who was also trained up. We used to drive up to Woomera, see the support, monitor the support from the ground, bring the records back with us the same day, start analysing them. That's a 700-mile round trip or something. But, we used to average 70 miles an hour, average, on those dirt roads. It was quite fun. And we were living in a, we had a house, a half a house, right on Largspear Beach. And we had an absolute ball. We conned the Elliots into providing us a ski boat, because we said we've all been contributing to the social club all these years and you're not doing anything for us, so what about it? And they said, all right, well, If that's what you want, we'll provide that, and you can sell it when you leave. And that's what happened. So we did snow skiing, water skiing, squash, bowling. We did loads and loads of things on the side, as well as going to work. And we were working out at WRE, which is the Weapons Research Establishment at Salisbury. It's a drive out from Adelaide every day. It's not very far. And I guess it was on one of our water skiing times I met my future wife, a girl from Queensland, and I then had to go back to England to do a conversion course onto the Mark II aircraft, higher altitudes and everything else. Went back and had 6 months in England to do other things as well. I was doing flying out of Woodford, and also going to training courses. Did one in Farnborough, which was great. Put you in a decompression chamber and take you up to 28,000 foot initially, and then you take your mask off and they see how long you last writing on a piece of paper until you eventually conk out, and you can see the signs in other people, the blue around the lips and all this sort of stuff. I'm sure RHS wouldn't allow that sort of thing these days, but anyhow, we used to do that. And then they'd take you and do an explosive decompression up to 56,000 feet, where the air goes white and everything expands and all the rest of it. All the gases and everything expand, including inside you, I might add. And you don't realise quite how bad it is in that chamber until you get into the fresh air afterwards. So that was good fun. And then I returned. I couldn't wait to get back to Australia. We carried on as before for another year, I suppose. And then eventually the contract was winding up. We had passed over. We trained up the RAF people to be able to use the systems. And so I returned to England. We had a choice of projects we might work on. One of them was Polaris missiles, submarines. I thought, well, that sounds pretty interesting. But then they had the TSR-2 aircraft, which was a supersonic bomber, which was going to be supplied to Australia, but Australia bought the F-111 instead, and that was the end of it. Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister, killed the project stone dead. So we had about a year on that TSR-2, which was great. We used to fly, do test runs, low-level flying in a Comet 4 over Dartmoor, which is quite interesting. The guy thought he was driving Spitfire, I think. And then we used to fly up to Keflavik in Iceland, and then down to Malta, and then over to Germany, and then back to Woodford again. And that was a standard sort of run. No, we were working out of Boscombe Down in that time. Sorry. Eventually, while I was still working at Boscombe Down, Betty, my Australian girlfriend, she came over, got a cargo boat over, and we got married in England. And from that point on, once the TSR-2 project had been cancelled, we had to find other work, and Elliot Scavis, me and several other fellows, job in the export sales for their big computers, and I was trying to flog the Russians these enormous valve jobs which occupied a whole room. Never sold anything as far as I can remember, but I used to have fun taking the Russians out to Karl Marx's grave was a favourite spot in Highgate Cemetery in London, and also the Prospector Whitby pub down on the Thames, which I went to just a few weeks ago, and it's great, hasn't changed at all. That's a terrific pub. So anybody going to London, go to the Prospector Whitby. It's been going since about 1600, and Frank Sinatra and Kennedy and, you know, numerous people have spent time there. So we were married, we were living in England, working out of Boscombe Down, and couldn't wait to get back to Australia, quite frankly. Really loved it out here after the first cultural shock when we first got out here, which is interesting. Adelaide, you know, on a Sunday, and you could buy a hammer but not a potato or whatever. Yeah, it was a bit of a culture shock initially, particularly the 6 o'clock closing in Adelaide, and the rule from the right, any traffic from your right had right of way. It didn't matter whether it was on a cart track or not. So that was interesting, to say the least. Yeah, the contract had finished. We were doing the TSR2, followed by trying to sell stuff to the Russians. I got a bit of travel then. We went to Prague and Russia and Holland and various things. And then I saw an advert, or I don't know, maybe Bob Cudmore might have written to me. But it turned out that all three tracking stations here in the ACT were recruiting around the time that I was desperate to get back out again. So I was interviewed in London by STC, who had the contract for Honeysuckle, and also by Spacetrack, who had the contract for Tibbinbilla, and can't remember who it was. But I also interviewed for Rural Valley, who knocked me back. But the other two sites, first of all, I was offered a job by Bob Cudmore in the deep space. And he sponsored my migration to Australia. We had to migrate. And then I was then offered a job at Honeysuckle, which was a manned space flight. And I thought, oh, that's going to be more exciting than this deep space stuff. We'll go for the manned space flight. So I told Bob, you know, I know you're sponsoring my migration and I don't want to work for you anymore. I want to work for Honeysuckle when I get out. And he said, that's okay. And he still sponsored the migration, which was really decent of him. Of course, we knew him pretty well from the Blue Steel days. He had been working over there all through the trials as well. But before he left Australia, they made him an offer he couldn't refuse. They kept upping the ante to get him to start up the Tibbinbilla site, right. Station 42 as it was then. So eventually, yes, we took the job at Honeysuckle. And migrated, but it wasn't quite that simple. I had to go over to Goddard to do a course before we got down to Australia, and I had to go back to England in order to migrate. So that was all right, because NASA in those days was flying people first class. Can you believe that? I went across first class on a VC-10. They were carving the roast beef beside the seat and everything. It was pretty impressive. But then, of course, the migration wasn't quite that clever. We didn't come out by boat. Betty went out early because they said, at this time she had an 8-week-old baby, and they said, oh, you can't be left without your husband. You'll have to go out to Australia first while he's in America. And they put her on a plane, and she had a wonderful trip out with all the thousands of babies strung along the aircraft. And they looked after her really well. And our eldest daughter, she came out as an 8-week-old. And I went to the, what they call the NTNTF, the Network Test and Training Facility in Goddard. And I met up with my opposite number, who was also a shift supervisor, operations supervisor on the console, a guy called Ken Lee. I met him on this training course, which was a generalized training course for maintenance and operations supervisors who are looking after the station as a whole. And I'll never forget the first time we fronted up at, well, we were on a fixed per diem. So we were all staying in some loft in some house with multiple sort of camp beds laid out at a very little cost, but they didn't provide breakfast. So the first day we fronted up at the coffee room in the basement of the network tests and training, and they had a machine in the corner which had hamburgers wrapped up in aluminium foil.
Yeah.
You could get them out of a machine and stick them in the microwave oven. Unfortunately, there weren't any microwave ovens very much in Australia at that time, and Ken decided he was going to have a hamburger, and he stuck it in the microwave oven, completely surrounded with aluminium foil. Of course, blew up the whole place. And if you've ever seen Americans first thing in the morning and they can't get their cup of coffee, it was not a pretty sight. But we survived. They said, bloody Australians, and that was it. So it was a good course. I enjoyed that. But we got very little travel, really, with manned spaceflight. There wasn't one thing. There was an awful lot going on, a lot of training and stuff. And then when they started flying in Apollo, of course, it was just crazy. We used to get the documentation for the next mission before we'd flown the one before it. And when I say documentation, I mean a stack that high. Of having had a little bit of training there, I had to go back to England and then fly down here, migrate down. Arrived in Sydney on Labor Day, 1966. Met up with my wife, who came back down from Brisbane, where she'd been staying with her parents. And then we moved to Canberra, and I started work at Honeysuckle Creek. They put us up in a motel, which was quite nice, and then we moved from there to a flat in Deakin, which was actually owned by Labour senators. And it was a contradiction of terms, really, all these polluted bloatocrats, senators in the Labour Party. So, yeah, we lived there, and then I went out to the station. I took a movie on the way out on my first day, and that was quite interesting. It was we were still using the old road up to Honeysuckle in those days, and the old road was quite good because they used to run the grader over it pretty regularly. They were busily building a road on the other side of the valley when we first started there. But if it rained, it was a different story. It could get very slushy and pothole-y, and it was good to get large people in the back seat bouncing up and down if possible, coming up the hill at least. So we got started, and we had a station director called Brownlow. He was a really nice guy, but he was an engineer and not really a manager. And so there were problems with Brown, apparently bigger than I realised. And he was fairly quickly replaced by Tom Reed, who had been working first at Woomera, then at Ural Valley. And he then transferred to Honeysuckle to sort things out, as they believed. And in fact, we were pretty terrible. You know, we didn't have any proper simulation equipment. We had every 6 months or 9 months or a year, a super constellation would come out and run simulations with us, and they'd have members of the simulation teams sitting around in the different areas in the station watching our performance and critiquing what was going on. And the aircraft were very hard to track, required a lot of coordination between the servo guy and the receiver people, because until the receivers were locked on properly, the servo guy had to point the antenna correctly and follow a trajectory which was in theory about right, and had been recorded on paper tape by the 1218 computers. In theory, it should have been relatively easy, but it's hard to track something which is moving in relation to the antenna, and the servo guy had to be really good to make sure that the errors were constantly zeroed out. And then when the receiver's locked up, you could then transfer the receiver data back to the servo, and it could be a closed loop automatic tracking. Yeah. The automatic track was a quite interesting situation in that there were four feed horns in the antenna, and the servo system was designed to null out any errors between the four, so they all had the same signal level, and thus the spacecraft was actually driving the antenna once you went to automatic track. But that couldn't be done until the receivers and servers had done their bit.
I guess very early in October of 1966 was when I first started with Honeysuckle, at Honeysuckle, and it was the beginning of 32 or over 30 fantastic years in various NASA facilities, working indirectly for NASA, and I couldn't have been happier. What a lucky guy was I to score that sort of job. Absolutely brilliant. However, as I say, when we first started, it just about got most of the equipment in by the time I arrived, and we were ready to go operationally. But there were quite a few problems to start with. We were close to getting ready for Apollo 1, but we were absolutely hopeless operationally as far as I was concerned. And as far as the NASA SIM team was concerned, it was run by a fellow called George Harris, who was not a man to mince his words. After our first set of simulations, our first couple of simulations, the first day or two, he got the entire station together down in the cafeteria in Honeysuckle. And I remember Brian Lowe, the station director, sitting cross-legged on top of the ice cream deep freeze machine, and various people around the place. And all the Americans we'd worked with before were so nice and pleasant and polite, and they never said anything was wrong. Anyhow, George Harris strode into the middle of this meeting and says, "You guys are a bunch of shit." And we all never heard of anything like that before.
Because George is a POM, isn't he?
George was a POM, yes. We were working our way towards Apollo 1, and then, of course, the far... I think we were on that. It was what they used to call a countdown demonstration test. Everything was done, including having the manned spaceflight network play back signals into the center and all the rest of it. So everybody was getting a good workout, and we weren't on at the time the FAR took place, but it was a pretty shocking moment for everybody in NASA at that time, and they'd never lost three astronauts before, hadn't lost any astronauts before. And of course that was actually in a way our saving grace, in that we had another 18 months to get ready for the first manned mission while they redesigned the command module. We were then able to get a little bit of experience tracking our first Saturn V launches. There were two Saturn V unmanned launches, we supported those two unmanned flights, which was interesting. The first one was quite successful, and the second one they got this pogo effect, which was a bit worrying when the third mission for that rocket was going to the moon. It was a very brave and courageous decision, as they would say in Yes Minister, to do that. So we our first manned mission was Apollo 7, and that was okay, but we were not really designed for Earth orbit missions. They were very short passes, and we didn't have any major problems on Apollo 7, as far as I can remember. And I was sitting on the operations console. Then they took us by surprise and said, well, the next mission's going to be a circumlunar mission on Apollo 8. And that was an incredible decision to make. And that was a fantastic mission. We came into our own on that mission because we were designed for lunar distance support, and we were just so lucky. We Apollo 8 was a lot of it was down in the southern hemisphere. We got the major portions of that mission, and I was very close to being the first man to speak to anybody in lunar orbit. My fingers were hovered over the button. It was a funny situation. Well, Mike Dinn decided that we were going to have maximum backup. We had eight receivers between the two stations on one spacecraft going around the moon, and but there was some controversy about if the Huygens antenna didn't acquire when they came out from behind the moon, then they would use what they called a backup voice mode. And so we had one, the lunar module bus was configured for the voice bus, was configured for the backup voice, and the command module voice bus was configured for command module primary mode voice. And a poor old fellow down the front end, one Kevin Gallegos, who was on the signal data demodulation, SUDS as we used to call them, he was trying to sort out whether it was primary voice or backup voice, and he was swapping stuff over down his end, and I was trying to find where the voice was. And I'll never forget hearing the astronauts come down. Their first thing they called a couple of times, and I could hear them, but Houston couldn't because we weren't remoted properly on the right bus, and I didn't know which bus it was. I was trying each, and Kevin was trying another lot down the other end. So they came out. He came out from behind the moon, and I can still hear the voice of Apollo guy saying, "We got data, but no voice." I hear that ringing in my ears, and I was so close to just pushing that button and say, "Look, we're sorting it out. We'll get you Houston in a second." but we persevered for a few more minutes. Well, not even a minute, probably. It seemed like an age. Mm-hmm. We got that sorted out, and we got the initial orbits and also the final orbits around the moon. We got the reading from Genesis and everything, which was, I still think that was a good deal, that one, even though I'm not a religious person, as you know. I thought it was pretty good to read that section from up there. And altogether, Apollo 8 was a magnificent mission for us. Everything went well. We got enormous experience in that first mission. The re-entry, was the fastest thing that had ever. They were well faster than speeding bullets. I've forgotten. Was it 36,000 kilometres per hour. But it was an interesting thing because we had Tibby Miller was backing us up and providing us with data as well, but they couldn't track the re-entry pass because it was just moving too fast for the speed of their antenna. But they used to try, and they'd set off along the track at maximum speed, and the spacecraft would come along behind, fly through their beam and out the other side.
Yeah.
And so they got a little bit of data through. So, yeah, splashdown went well. It was just a magnificent mission. And then we followed with Apollo 9, Apollo 10, Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17. I sat through them all. No, not through them. I sat on the console for the major portions of those missions. Yes, Apollo 9 was fascinating because it was in Earth orbit again, and there was two vehicles, and you know these guys were flying off away from each other, and if they didn't link up again, they would have fried trying to get in with the LEM. But good mission. And then Apollo 11. Apollo 11 was great. You know, it all went according to plan. It was like a simulation with no faults. It was great. But as everybody said, you know, who's been working the consoles at that time, was nobody had time to look at the television really, very much at all. It was all biomed, and the backpack data and all that sort of thing was the most important part of it. And then the television was fairly low down the list of priorities, although subsequently, as you know, the television's taken a very high profile compared with how we treated it at the time.
Do you want to talk about John Gorton's visit that morning?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was not really happy that Tom Reed had apparently invited the Prime Minister of the day, John Gorton, who used to be a Spitfire pilot, I believe, and was interested in engineering and technology generally, one of the very few Prime Ministers who really was interested. Yeah, anyhow, Tom had invited John Gorton to come around on the day of Armstrong's exiting from the landing and the exit from the lunar module and the first EVA on the lunar surface. And we were all preparing, and there was this enormous diversion of. And perhaps before that, I should mention that the opening day was fun. I remember we had a chief engineer who had been told to organise the opening day stuff, and didn't take kindly to me saying to Goddard that, yeah, we can track lunar orbiter if that's what you'd like us to do. He thought it was going to interfere with the preparations for opening day. But anyhow, we eventually tracked lunar orbiter. There was a story there, of course. Of they sent us 30-foot predicts for the Northern Hemisphere, and they were absolutely no good for us at all. So we had a fellow called Ian Anderson up in the antenna cone with a pair of binoculars looking for the moon and saying left a bit, right a bit, up a bit, down a bit. His favourite expression was, "It's so close it hurts." And anyhow, we eventually got the right predicts, and we were able to take a look at lunar orbiter and a few other things. Good experience for the front end, the antenna and USB people. And then Apollo 11, well, Apollo 11 went well. As I say, hardly got a chance to look at the television very much. There was a bunch of people in the operations room, which clogging up the works, so we had to shoo some of those away over the PA. But the quality of the television we saw was really pretty darn good compared with what eventually ended up on people's televisions. I think there was quite a lot, well, there's a discussion going on at the moment about what caused all the problems in the data and you the television signal, and you were well aware of that as to... I thought it was the microwave links primarily, and particularly the satellite links and microwave links, because all the circuits had to be tuned up, especially for the television, and it was quite an exercise, and they couldn't... Well, there were several things about the television. The first thing was that it cost $15,000 an hour for satellite time in those days, and so we couldn't run too many television simulations back to the States because of this. And also we used to take all the bandwidth for Canberra, and the people used to miss out on their news and all sorts of things when we ran simulations, so we couldn't do that. And also, of course, as far as the picture on the lunar surface was concerned, nobody could simulate that. Nobody knew what it was going to be like. And our guy did a great job of tweaking up the signal as far as he could. It was a very alien-looking picture, so nobody expected it to look like that, I don't think. But, yeah, Edwin Renoir did a marvellous job with that. And poor old fellow at Goldstone wasn't so lucky because he was on the backup team. I used to have a go at the Goldstone people about that whole system of training one team to be the primary team and another team to be the backup team, and not giving them the same amount of training. That was really bad. As far as I was concerned, operationally it was terrible. So Houston eventually took our picture, as we all know, and that was what went out to the world. So we were pretty happy with that. And Royal Parks was just below their 30 degree elevation limit, and were close on 2 hours behind us as far as moonrise was concerned. And they came up about 8 or 9 minutes or something like that after we first sent the first TV. So, yeah, Apollo 11 was good. As I say, it was like a simulation that went well. Didn't feel any particular sense of elation or anything like that, unlike other people, perhaps. Just too busy.
And Apollo 13, I guess, was the other big one?
Well, the next, yes, we got more experience with Apollo 12, which was quite a good mission. And then along came Apollo 13, where, as Mike Dinn would say, we earned our money. It was pretty tricky. It's been written up in many places now about how we developed procedures on the fly to compensate for having two spacecraft on the same frequency, the Saturn IV-B, which couldn't be turned off, there was no command system on it, and within our beam width, the lunar module, which the crew was using as a lifeboat. And we had to separate the carrier signals from those two spacecraft, and it was done by basically getting the lunar module to turn their signal off while we grabbed hold of the Saturn IV-B signal and stressed it out slightly to one side, and then the LEM signal could be turned back on again, and we picked that up and stressed it out to the other side.
And that's because the transponder would follow your uplink frequency, is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the whole system was a closed loop, beautifully designed system, a universal S-band system, USB system. You had, it was all done with phase lock loops, and you had the time standard, which was phase locked by the exciter, which then went to the transmitter. Transmitter went up to the spacecraft. The spacecraft received it with the phase lock loop, and then turned it around by 240 over 221 ratio. I do remember that, and sent the in phase again, and then sent it out with a transmitter which was phase locked to their receiver on the spacecraft, which was then phase locked on the ground back to the time standard again. The whole thing was one big loop, and but with Apollo 13 it was a matter of keeping up with the Doppler effects, you know, as well as keeping the two vehicles apart. You had to move the whole lot because of the Doppler, and then it was okay because by the time they started heading home, I think the S4B had actually crashed onto the lunar surface, which was the point of it, to provide seismic activity for the two seismometers that were on the moon by that time. Parks was up, and we had a it was marginal whether Parkes was that much better than our own signals, because that had to go through a bunch of equipment before it got to us. So, but there was a political imperative to use Parkes whenever possible. Tom Reed was very insistent on that because of the Australian connection. And so anyhow, Apollo 13 was, yes, it was a hard mission with a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. And Bruce Window and Roy Stewart went up to Parkes along with a few other guys and got Parkes going in double quick time, and PMG did a great job on the microwave links and all the rest of it, but we managed okay without the Parkes data.
That was good to have.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yes. Diversity is a thing, weather diversity and all sorts of, yeah, the whole method of supporting manned space flight was to have a lot of diversity and redundancy in the system so that you could, if something failed, you could usually swap over to something else. The next real mission, as far as we're concerned, my second favourite mission, was Apollo 15. First time they, it was about twice as complicated as the previous missions in terms of number of downlinks, amount of data, the lunar rover, which provided a lot of excitement, particularly to the poor fellow trying to sort out the signal when the astronauts used to leave the thing transmitting while they were driving along, and all the things they weren't meant to do. Yeah, they were meant to point the antenna at the Earth and then, you know, switch it off while they drove to the next point, but they didn't bother half the time. And they drove along, and the poor fellow down the front end was trying to sort out all the signals, whether they were relaying via the lunar module or whether it was coming direct via the rover's antenna and so on. That was a great mission, though, and I remember Dave Scott wore his hands out on drilling holes in the lunar surface, trying to get a heat probe down, I think. Apollo 15 was the mission where the lunar module was called Endeavour, and they sprung a water leak 200 years to the day almost that Cook sprung a leak up in Cooktown in his Endeavour boat. And so Laurie Turner, who was he wrote down the story, and we sent it off to Houston, and they uplinked the story that they had sprung a leak. And when Dave Scott and Al Warden came down, we presented them with a big scroll telling this whole story. It was quite a coincidence. So, yes, and then we had 15, 16 and 17. Along the way, we had Chris Craft and everybody come around and tell us how we got jobs for life and all the rest of it. And unfortunately, the American public and the and Congress didn't look at it the same way. Chris Craft had said we would get into habitats on the moon fairly soon, and there'd be shuttle services going backwards and forwards, then off to Mars and all the rest of it. And of course none of that happened, but Skylab followed on.
Do you want to talk about your discussion on Apollo 16 with
that was a total embarrassment to me. It really was. I did think it was my job to keep an eye on the uplink to the spacecraft to make sure that our transmitters were being modulated and all the other things were right, the remoting and these Quindar tone receivers which switch the transmitter on and off. You hear the beep beep. And yeah, it was my job to keep an eye on that, and we got to a period in between a couple of their EBAs on Apollo 16 when John Young and Charlie Duke were in the lunar module, and they called down and never got any response from Houston, and called a couple of times, and I took a good look around and I could see that Houston were going up to the spacecraft, but Houston were not going up to the spacecraft. But they could hear the spacecraft, apparently. I didn't realise at the time. I thought we'd lost the lines to Houston both ways. So eventually I was forced into pushing the buttons and telling them that we were trying to sort the problem out. And it was all very disappointing because they had lost the high-gain antenna on the lunar module. The problem with that, and so they were on the Omni antennas, were very, very noisy down there, and I could hardly make out what John Young was saying. But what he was saying was, I could do with a swan, and he meant a swan lager or swan beer because he'd been in Western Australia quite a lot, working out of Carnarvon when they had astronauts doing Capcoms at these times, the Gemini. And anyhow, eventually I got the idea that that's what he was talking about, so I was busily trying to talk to Canberra Switch at the same time, seeing what the hell was going on. Canberra Switch were not at all concerned. They said, oh, well, you're going to hand over to Madrid soon. What are you going on about? But so I was trying to do that and trying to talk to the spacecraft as well. And so we ended up talking about Swan Largo, and I said, well, you know, we'll keep them cold for you, come down.
Orion, this is Honeysuckle. We have a comm outage with Houston at this time. Stand by one, please.
Okay, Honeysuckle, nice to talk to you. How are y'all doing down there?
We're doing great. Nice to talk to you. Appreciate it. It's a pleasure working on this mission.
Roger, we'd sure like to come down there and see you folks after Stonewood, too.
Well, you've got a permanent invite anytime you like.
John Young came down quite a few times after that, but it was never convenient or suitable, I thought, to bail him up. But eventually on the 20th anniversary of the 25th Apollo 11, we had him down as a guest of honour, and I was able to present him with a beer. So yeah, that was Apollo 16, and as a result of that conversation, Swan Brewery sent a whole lot of beer over to the astronauts in Houston, and we rang them up and said, well, we have splashdown parties as well. And they sent over 48 crates of 12 750 litre bottles, and everybody, by the time everybody on both Tibimbilla and Honeysuckle had got their bottle, there was none left. That was about it. We had one bottle each. It was all good fun. The 3J missions, 15, 16 and 17, were great. They were really interesting. Lots of stuff happening, all these extra downlinks and processing. But then we moved on and completely redid the station yet again for Skylab. I never thought we were going to be able to support Skylab. It was just an order of magnitude more complex than Apollo, as far as I was concerned. Oh, you're just taking a picture of my
Skylab.
So I never thought it was going to work. I really didn't. It was incredibly complex. It was an order of magnitude more complex on the digital side of the house. The USB, the radio frequency side of the house, was similar, although, you know, you had to acquire an Earth orbit and all the rest of it. Not too bad. But there were many more downlinks and uplinks. There was a few VHF and UHF. UHF was command uplink and VHF was voice up and down, if I remember correctly. And but the data processing was just brilliant. It was just brilliant. Every parameter had a priority, and every parameter also had was also marked whether or not it was going to be sent in real time or not. And we had a total, I think, by that time of 28 kilobits per second combined over three voice lines, specially tuned voice lines, modems, 18-inch racks, about that deep, one modem for 7.2 kilobits. So it was 21, 22, or whatever, total megabits per second. And the downlinks were coming in at umpteen megabits per second. So every parameter was checked for whether it had to go out in real time or not, what its priority was, and only the higher priority ones were sent in real time. Everything was recorded on digital tape in the computer area and also the analog area in the telemetry. And straight after the pass, I got into all the playbacks. There were many, many types of data being played back. We had lots of voice dumps, telemetry dumps, recorded in the spacecraft when they weren't in contact with the ground station. And altogether, it was great. It did eventually work. And in fact, you know, it worked from square one on Skylab, which absolutely amazed me. Never thought it was going to work as well as it did. And by the time we'd done 2,000 or 3,000 reps, we were getting quite slick at it. We really enjoyed it because you could relax even when it was a complicated pass. And the only bad thing about Skylab was it had to end eventually. We went through all the different manned periods and the unmanned periods and crew sleep periods and non-sleep periods and so on. It was always exciting as far as I was concerned. We used to stop the local traffic for every pass. Oncoming shifts and things used to have to queue up down the road. So, yes, eventually Skylab came to an end, and in 1974, or thereabouts, 73, 74, we became a deep space network station. 1974-75 at the end of Skylab. You know, station was completely gutted almost, and new computers, new telemetry equipment, new everything. So we changed to deep space. We thought it was rather going backwards in some ways, because you don't get the same visibility of the spacecraft, and you only find out what happened quite a lot after the event, quite probably when you've got a few lithographs and things came down. And however, we were supporting Pioneers 10 and 11, Helios, two Helios spacecraft, Voyager 1 and 2, of course. We used to work around the clock. We had four shifts, and by that point I was responsible for operations in Honeysuckle. There was no departmental people there, but I was working, I guess, for Tom Reed in Tibbabilla. We had four shifts, three or four people in each shift originally, and then eventually it got down to just two or three people. And you had to cope with annual leave and sickness and everything else. So I remember towards the end of our time there, I was contacted by an Apollo simulation guy called Bob Stanley, who's a good friend of mine over the years, and he was working some simulations at Auroral, and I said, well, why don't you come on over? I'm up here at Honeysuckle. He came over, he couldn't believe it, because I was the only guy on site, apart from the powerhouse man and the guard. And I was tracking pulsars for a guy called Dr. Manchester. He was interested in pulsar rotation consistencies. That was pretty standard stuff, but I was the only one. And Bob couldn't believe it. But there we were. Anyhow, we were quite busy with all the Apollo missions, all the deep space missions, and in particular the Voyager missions, as far as I was concerned, I thought were fantastic. Viking missions to Mars, it was sort of exciting, but and I couldn't work out how we could support four spacecraft with four receivers between two stations. That was Tibbabilla and ourselves. There was only two receivers by this time on each station. But then Ricardo reminded me that, of course, 43 was up then, and they had four receivers, so they could support, I think, just about all the spacecraft at once. But then you had all the redundancy and diversity. Mm. Yeah, that went on for a few years, and it was all quite quiet, but I was getting a fair few trips over to the States by this time, mainly on learning first of all about their operations, but then later on designs of future replacement consoles and this type of thing. So I got involved quite a lot in that and was going back and forth a bit. And then in 1980, it became apparent they changed all the lights from incandescent to fluorescent, and they regraded the road and they put another water tank in, so it was obvious they were going to close the station down. And we could see the writing on the wall. And what was happening was that we were being offered a downgrade if we wanted to go to Tibbabilla when Honeysuckle was closed in 1981. So I didn't like the idea of that very much. So I said, oh, well, I'll take two of your supervisor jobs if you keep, and I can keep my current grade. So I took over from one of the ops supervisors in the office, plus the training supervisor, who were both leaving around that time. So I took two jobs and didn't do either of them very well. And but I kept my grading, and shortly after that I moved over to TID, and went on to operations there. And I spent, I guess, 3 or 4 years working one of the teams at Tibbinbilla on quite a lot of missions there. And then I was there 15 years, and it was after 5 years I became the operations manager out there. I spent my last 10 years as operations manager at Tibbinbilla. By this point, I was able to get more travel into JPL. They were looking at things, and they offered the entire station redundancies. And I looked at it, and I thought, well, hey, if I can get a job lined up at JPL. I took a voluntary redundancy and went back the next day as a consultant to JPL. So I went over to JPL, firstly on a project which was re-engineering the Deep Space Network. I spent a year in this room with a whole bunch of people, including my good friend Les Deutsch, who was running the group, who fantastic guy. We produced it cost over $1 million, that team, which is crazy. It doesn't sound much these days, but it over $1 million that we were travelling around to various places. And yeah, it was great. We came up with crazy ideas, including this one, which I was keen on. Was I always hated shift work, and I thought it was bad for the systems. And I thought, wouldn't it be marvellous if everybody could just work day work? Or day shift, preferably 12-hour day shift. And came up with this idea of running of one station on day work, running the other two sites. And, you know, this was at the time when JPL couldn't even design something that could be remotely controlled, let alone automated in any way. But at the end of this $1 million study, JPL said, well, you can't afford any of that. We spent all the money on the study and don't have enough money to do anything. But I've seen over the years more and more and more of what we suggested has been implemented. And I think we did a reasonably good job. So we did that, and then I went and worked on the monitoring control side of the house and talked about bubble-up displays and all sorts of interesting stuff. Proposing. So I spent, I think, about 2.5 years over at JPL after I retired, and I already had 6 months with the family over there, and so I spent about nearly four years working at JPL. So that was the end of my career with NASA. When that lot came to an end, I was sitting over in a motel there one day, and I thought, why am I doing this? I was just so damn lucky. And after that, I knuckled down and I started doing a lot of volunteer work for the PC Users Group here, who used to be the biggest non-profit organisation in town, when we were the only people providing internet services to the whole of Canberra. So we became our own ISP. I was doing a lot of work helping people with their computer problems and lecturing about computers. And altogether, I feel I've been incredibly lucky.